So Jake, thank you very much for being here today. I really appreciate you being on the Practical Broker podcast, and it means a lot to me to have you here and willing to do this and share your knowledge. I've known you for, I think, going on 15 years now, and I think our careers have been in a parallel trajectory for quite a while on different sides of the fence, but you know, we first met when you were building single homes, I think, way back when. So how did you decide to get into architecture and building homes?
Great question. So thanks again for having me here, Chad. It's a real pleasure. We actually met, I think, a little bit longer ago, and we met prior to me actually building homes. So you first met me when I was still struggling as a young investor and doing anything possible to scramble enough money together to purchase a house and then another house and so on. So yeah, you met me right at the early days. I guess your question was how did I decide to get into this? I've had an entrepreneurial drive, I guess, for a long time. I was practicing as an intern architect. I did that for a couple of years. I kind of projected myself out 10, 20, 30 years, and then questioned whether that is where I wanted to be in terms of my professional accomplishments or career path.
I remember you were working on some pretty big towers back then.
Yeah, ironically, we were actually working on large apartment buildings, which is what we're doing now. In my practice and in the work that we do, it wasn't right for me at the time. I thought I wanted a bit more control over my life and an opportunity to do other things and to actually have a bit more control over the process of making those things. So that's a great observation. These projects came into our office, as a young architect, I would have imagined that as the architect, we would have had a certain modicum of control over the making of these things. And of course, it turned out to be the owner. So when the owner came in the office, the owner, it was his project or her project, and they would be calling the shots. And I realized after a little while then that I wanted to be that person.
You wanted to be the owner.
I wanted to be the owner rather than the person that's doing the work. So that was kind of the genesis for this career. It was a desire to have more control over the work that we do, still retain an interest in the design and the ideation and creation of these buildings, but at the end of the day, like you said, to be an owner rather than to be someone that's part of the larger process of making these things.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really great. I've noticed through your career that one of the successes I've seen you had from the outside is really engaging the city and the community. And I know you're mentioning before that you're actually in Ottawa. We're having rezoning of the R4 zoning, and you're part of that committee with the city. What was that like?
I guess there's two questions there. I'll start with the second, the experience working with the R4 working group. I mean, I think it's a big privilege to have an opportunity to provide some insight and some input, particularly with this endeavor to change the R4 zoning. So the R4 zoning is what's commonly referred to as the missing middle, where we do have a lot of intensification. I'll back up a little bit. The city really does want to drive more intensification. It's working on the new official plan right now, the big driving force in that official plan is a desire to double down on the city's intensification efforts. So rather than expand the urban boundary, they want to see up to 60% of new homes being built within the green belt, which is it's a very ambitious target. So they've realized that if they are serious about this and they want this to actually work, they're going to need to look carefully at where intensification is not happening successfully right now and is not happening successfully in the R4 zones, particularly what are called the junior R4 zones. So R4As to Js, I think, the zones that are particularly applied to lots that are a little bit smaller. So they're seeing an opportunity for greater intensification here, and so they struck the committee to better understand what can be done to ensure that the new zoning that's written reflects the current reality and really is effective at enticing positive development in these zones. So what they're looking to do is primarily to increase the potential for density in these zones, which has been artificially restricted. So in the junior zones, you're only allowed up to 4 units. In the senior zones, you could do a little bit more, but typically all the zones are restricted artificially by what the city is now calling these kinds of force fields that they put on these zones, such as rear yard requirements, landscape requirements. certain restrictions that were meant to provide a certain amenity to a site, but really were written in a way to restrict development and density. And so they're taking away those restrictions, and they're increasing the amount of units that are permissible on these sites. And so you're going to see really significant opportunities for additional density, and you know, for listeners that are interested in development or investing in real estate, you're going to see a lot more opportunities in these zones in the coming year or two.
That's awesome. I remember the sixplex that I bought. It was a rooming house back in Centertown, and I think there was 45 people in this rooming house, and then I wanted to convert it to a sixplex, and they gave me so much trouble. That's going back about 4 or 5 years, and I was going to have less people in the building than it did as a rooming house as a sixplex, but because it was one of those force fields you're talking about where eventually we got it approved, but having that creativity with the city is a nice change.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that story, because the R4 exercise is actually composed of two parts, and the part that I was involved in was the second part. The first part was there to help to limit and prohibit the prevalence of what the city calls bunkhouses. Mm-hmm. So what you had there was a bunkhouse, an illegal rooming house, and it's deeply ironic that they would have made it difficult for you to change it into a legal apartment building, because the last 3 years, through intensive discussions with community associations and counselors, there's been a huge drive to try and eradicate that type of housing option. And that was really the genesis for the R4 review. There was even a moratorium in Sandy Hill on any construction for quite some time until the phase one of this R4 review was released. And now they're working on the second one.
Absolutely. Yeah, I find it kind of ironic that they're asking so much intensification and they want creative development, and then they throw so many roadblocks in our ways to try to stop things. But I'm glad that they're actually getting developers in communities and doing these type of engagements. It makes a big difference.
Yeah, and I think as you know, I'm going to make a little shout out to the Greater Ottawa Home Builders Association. So they've been really pivotal in engaging with the city and creating this dialogue. So if there are developers, builders out there listening to this podcast, I'd ask them to look into, you know, the positive work that GOBA does and to seeing if there's opportunities for them to contribute. So that's how I got involved. I'm part of the Urban Infill Council on GOBA. And when the city was looking for members to join that effort, I got selected to participate. So it was through GOBA, and again, it's GOBA does a lot of fantastic work to represent the interests of the construction industry, and to also provide a kind of a sober second thought for some of the policies that are being developed at City Hall. The planners and members of staff do rely on GOBA to provide that industry expertise when they're drafting policy, and you know, I'm happy to contribute and would encourage others to do the same.
Absolutely. In my industry, in the mortgage world, we have two associations, and I've always said to all of our staff over the years, it's, you know, a couple $100 a month. GOBA is significantly more expensive, but the work that some of these associations do for the industry that you're in, people don't realize how much lobbying they're doing, how much sober second thought that they're pushing back on politicians that aren't in the jobs that we do every day.
Yeah.
And they need that counterbalance.
Absolutely. And it's actually tremendous, the amount of work that they do, which you know, you typically wouldn't see. Every single policy that gets discussed at the city is tabled at GOBA, and there's committees that look at it, and feedback is given to staff, meetings are held with staff, and you know, when things are highly counterproductive to the industry's interests, you know, these things are appealed or taken to court. So there's real action that takes place. But for people who aren't developers, or maybe you're in your industry, I would encourage them to join anyways, because it's a fantastic networking opportunity. You have an immediate connection to most every builder developer in the city. So for two reasons, it encourages a healthy ecosystem, and there's a great opportunity to network and generate business.
That's great. So tell me a little bit, and tell our listeners a little bit of when you first started. You were building single homes, and then you got into some creative renovations where you're adding units onto some properties. This is your career. It's very common for builders to start with singles and semis, and then they scale up. What was that like?
Challenging and difficult, mostly painful. Yeah, it's a slow start. So I didn't start with any experience in the industry, apart from, you know, a background in architecture, but certainly no background in development of any sorts. I also started with no money. I started with negative money, so I started with school debts, which wasn't very helpful. I started with a career that didn't pay very well, so there wasn't an opportunity to you know, to leverage and to borrow effectively. And I didn't really have any resources, mentors, or basically anything, right? So when you start really at the bottom, you got to start slowly, and you kind of work your way up that ladder, and you know, over time it becomes easier. But when I started, it was buying a house, not because it was the best investment, but because literally it was the only house I could afford in the city.
Yeah.
And I renovated a basement into an apartment. A little bit of equity upside allowed me to buy a triplex, which allowed me to buy a sixplex, which allowed me to buy an eightplex. And then eventually built up enough equity to be able to start to develop. So the first project we did was a small apartment building in Sandy Hill, where we bought a single family home, put on an addition, built an extra four apartments, had a fiveplex, and again, you know, generated a little bit more equity there, and kind of pooled all that together, then built our first proper development, which was one single and two semis.
Yeah.
And then some townhouses and some more singles, and then a small apartment building, and then eventually we got into condos, and you know, went from 18, 20 unit buildings. Now we're doing 50, 80, and then we have projects in soft development for 260 to 500 units.
That's quite amazing.
The growth is, you know, can be exponential, and so over the first number of years of this, people out there that are listening that are just starting out, they're probably seeing only struggle, and they're probably frustrated that the growth is slow. It always does appear slow at the beginning because you're doubling from one unit to two units, from two units to four units, and so on. When you start going from 50 to 100 or from 100 to 200, that's significant. That's significant growth, and is rapid growth at that point. So the challenge you come across is how to manage that growth. Where at the beginning you're struggling to attain that level of growth. Once you've got it, then you got to figure out what to do with it. And that's kind of where we are right now.
Absolutely. And how have your team changed over the years? So obviously when you're doing a single or a double, it's definitely a different team than you have now at 150 units. But at each stage, I've kind of noticed that there's different professionals that you need, different staff, mentors around you.
Sure. And at each stage, it's challenging and it's difficult. And you know, when you start, you have no money, so you can't hire anybody. And you're left doing everything yourself, but you're not the expert at everything. And so you learn through a lot of mistakes, and you have to work in twice as many hours because you can't afford to find that support. And then slowly you do find support, but you can't really offer a great career to someone when you're just starting out yourself. And you also don't have a lot of money, so you typically don't attract the best help. And so that, you know, that in itself becomes, well, it's a bit of an assistance, can become a bit of a challenge. And then, you know, that kind of struggle follows you through, I guess, the evolution of your business, because, you know, as you continue to grow, your needs are always one or two steps ahead, but your present reality is where it presently is. And so you always try and make an effort to attract the best talent that you can. And you really, your only leverage is to pitch the future. But, you know, for most people, they look at the reality and what's happening today, and they don't have that kind of a vision. And so it's always a challenge to attract the right talent. And then, you know, as you grow, as you've said, your needs change, your requirements change. So, you know, you try and look for opportunities to nurture staff, nurture their skills, and to have them grow with your business. But at other times, depending on how quickly you're growing, you need to bring in outside talent. And particularly to shore up, you know, the shortcomings that you might have, right? So in our case, we're now moving into high-rise concrete construction. We've not ever built buildings like this before, and you know, making mistakes at this scale, you know, could shut our doors, right? So we want to make sure that we're not making those mistakes, and that means hiring the right people. And we've been very fortunate recently to make a couple of key hires that, you know, share our vision, see the opportunity in terms of what we're doing, and are willing to contribute.
Yeah, I've seen that. You've recruited some top talent. That's amazing.
We have. Yeah, we've been very lucky, particularly in the market that we're in right now, which is extremely competitive. It's hard to find anybody out there. We were forced to go outside of Ottawa. Both of our hires came from Alberta, and it was just good timing that they wanted to relocate to Ottawa, and we needed someone that had their skill set.
Perfect. So one of the successes I've seen you over the years is a lot of builders, and especially the smaller builders, face the community challenge, you know, the NIMBY, not in my backyards. Yeah. And of course, I've known you've had some of that resistance, but overall, compared to my other clients as builders, you've had more success dealing with community than a lot of other people. And what do you attribute that to?
Perseverance and I guess maybe creative problem solving. I mean, I don't feel like I've had that much success only because it always feels like a never-ending struggle. And I think what's important is to understand that there is a process that you can follow to make a better outcome for all parties. And that is something you have to try and focus on, as challenging as that might be. I mean, at the end of the day, you have your interests and you have your objectives, but you are building what you're building within a broad community, and there are other stakeholders outside of yourself. And while it can be a challenge, you really do need to take those voices into account and understand how important that constellations of needs is, and to best understand, you know, what you can offer that will best satisfy those needs without it being overly detrimental to your interests. And that's a fine balancing act that just takes a lot of time and experience to kind of work out. But if I could give some level of advice, I would say that, you know, consultation is critical, and I would say, you know, it doesn't cost you very much to have a conversation. So reach out and have those conversations. Reach out proactively. Don't formulate a pro forma and spend money on designs and studies to then realize that there's a significant issue that a community association or a counselor is going to have with your proposal. Start to have those conversations early on. Reach out proactively. Speak to the counselor. Speak to the community association. Speak to your neighbors, and be willing to hear things that you might not want to hear, right? And do your best to understand those concerns and to look for creative solutions that work for all parties.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was having a meeting yesterday with a local developer, and he's building a 5-story building, and at first the community was all against him just because of the type of siding that he was putting on and just the look of the building. So then him and his architect came together with a few other looks, and that was really their only objection, was just the actual look. So as soon as they changed the look, everybody was super happy. They got rid of a roof amenity space that they were worried that was going to cause, you know, some noise problems and that kind of stuff. And the community was just ecstatic.
Right. And so that listening is so important there, right? Because, I mean, you can take guesses as to what's going to make people happy. And often I've run afoul in that sense, where I've just made the arrogant assumption that I know best and I know what a community is going to want. And it can lead to some bitter disappointment, because you feel like you put in a huge amount of effort trying to really offer something you think is valuable, to just be turned away and told that, you know, that's the absolute opposite of what they want. So, you know, I've learned those lessons too, to first listen and then try and put some ideas to paper. And you know, there's not always a solution, but quite often there are, and every little bit helps. So like I said, it starts with listening and then looking for those creative solutions, like, you know, altering the siding on a building or making adjustment to some amenity areas.
That's awesome. So you've had a lot of projects over the years. I mean, some really great successes and some challenges. Is there any two that highlights one of your successes or one of the challenges you faced, and how have you overcome that?
Well, they've all had challenges. So I can't say there's been one that was easy. There hasn't been anything easy. I think, you know, things maybe would have gotten easier if we decided to plateau at some level, right? Because then you become comfortable with what you're doing. You can kind of rinse and repeat, and hope to not, redo mistakes. But our goal has always been to grow as rapidly as we could. And so every project has been larger and more complicated than the last. And so inevitably that opens up opportunities to make mistakes and to encounter challenges. But you know, that's one thing that, and I say it half jokingly, but yeah, like you will always have challenges. And if you're in business, you have to expect challenges. And if you're looking to grow your business, there's always going to be challenges. And it's something that you need to become good at resolving and dealing with, right? Both on a personal level and professionally as well. So you need to not be overwhelmed by some of these struggles that come. And then you need to know how to resolve some of these issues, right? So that technical competency and the experience is pivotal. And
not let it completely internalize it and just devastate you every time you're faced with a challenge.
Exactly, because they're always going to be there, and you got to realize that that's just part of the environment that you work in. As much as you try and execute things as perfectly as you want, you know, we work in a complex environment that has a lot of outside forces that bear on the work that you do, and not everything is within your control. And so inevitably something will come up, and you know, like appeals are one of those things where you can work proactively with a community association, you can work with a counselor, you can even have the support of your counselor in a community association. But it doesn't mean that some aggrieved neighbor that, you know, never voiced their concerns to you, you know, never appeared on the radar, isn't gonna find $150 in their pocket to lodge an appeal, right, which then might really jeopardize the viability of your project, right? Because then to hear an appeal, even if you have the $30,000 to $60,000 to defend your position, can take a year to 2 years before you get resolution. And with a lot of projects, you don't have 2 years, you're gonna go bankrupt before you get there. So, you know, these are significant challenges, and they're difficult to resolve, and they're easy to attract, I guess, you know, for lack of better words, because it doesn't take very much for the other side to provide this kind of a challenge. It's $150. And if they want to perfect that appeal, they then need to start hiring professional help, but you know, they can delay that for quite some time, and they can limit their costs significantly. So
yeah, a lot of people don't realize the risk that developers take when you buy land and you're planning 3, 4, 5 years out, and that $150 can delay you 2 years.
Oh, absolutely. When you've got carrying costs, so you've got just, you know, your typical burn rate and your overhead, but then you've got the carrying costs of that property. And then it's not just a property, it's part of your pipeline. And so these projects need to get underway, they need to get under construction, and they need to terminate to generate revenue, because if you don't have that revenue, you're out of business. Yeah. And so you can't just put it off for 2 years, because you can't put off, you know.
Oh, you could just wait, it's all good.
Yeah, of course, yeah, the money's gonna come from somewhere.
Yeah.
So it's critical to keep vigilant about you know, some of these risk factors and how they might arise, and then how to best deal with them.
That's great. Well, it's a great segue into my next question, which is one of your elements of secret sauce that I've kind of been observing over the years. I won't steal it. In addition to the community work and engaging the neighbors and stuff, which a lot of builders don't, and I've never understood. The first thing I always say to them, go talk to your neighbors, and then they're scared, so they don't. But the other aspect for you is you find creative solutions for land. You found land that's off market, you've repurposed land that other builders or that's been on the market that other people overlooked, and you've seen a vision. And you just attribute that to your architecture background, or?
I guess initially probably to my schooling. I think architecture is you know, advanced problem solving, and we're taught to take in you know, various levels of input and to try and synthesize those to solve a problem. And with architecture, they're typically related to creating spaces. But you know, when you're designing a building, you have to take into account the zoning. You have to take into account user comfort. You have to take into account laws and bylaws. You have to take into account the kind of economic prerogatives of your client. You have to take into account weather, you know, how users use the space. I mean, there's so many different layers that go into making a decision at the end of the day. Is the object going to be this or this? But the constellation of factors that revolve around it that allow you to make those decisions is quite complex, and it's quite multifaceted. And so I think that's in terms of the ability to solve those kinds of problems, I think that's that kind of training was beneficial. Mm-hmm. Not to suggest that, you know, that's the only thing you can rely on. Right. And while I've had a lot of success in that respect, you know, it's smaller successes that led to bigger ones, because at the beginning, there's other things you need to learn that you don't know, right? And so there's a lot about this industry that you don't come out of architecture school knowing, and financing is a huge component. Understanding the market, market trends, being able to forecast, and you know, really understanding the various zoning and bylaw implications that might affect a property, all those kinds of things. Those are things that you learn, and so yes, there have been successes, and but you know, the initial ones were small but big enough that allow me to continue to drive forward and to continue to grow. But now we're in a position where we can make larger plays that maybe are a little bit riskier, but are also more impactful in terms of the return. So we made some investments recently that, you know, are paying out 10 times the money we've invested in the property. So 10 times the purchase price in a very short period of time, within, you know, less than 2 years. So that's a good return on your investment, considering you're only contributing a small percentage. You know, if you got a great guy like you helping out, right? You're not contributing as much equity to the deal. So just for that limited percentage of equity, to create 10 times value in a property means 40 times the return, right, in a short period of time. So those opportunities, they don't come around every day, but you know, if you give yourself the time to build up that level of expertise and awareness, you'll be more apt to find those opportunities.
So that's, as we're just talking about, you know, you don't realize how much you know, and you've been in the industry for so long. And that's part of the reason why I love being here and doing these kind of interviews, is we get to share and hope to give some guidance to not just interesting younger people, but people that are starting their industry, starting their career. Just on the short break we had, we were talking about it'd be nice to take our knowledge back in time and have that wisdom. But is there anybody that's been influential that you've been learning? Like, where have you sourced some of this information, and how did you learn?
Well, that was one of the greatest challenges, and it's so nice that you mention all this, because I feel grateful for the opportunity to give back a little bit, because this is not something that I had. You know, when I was starting out, the internet was barely a thing. You couldn't find a book on real estate development, certainly not anything that was geared towards, you know, starting out a career in this. I mean, there were books on maybe developing or managing a large real estate portfolio, you know, in buildings of 500 units or so, which you don't get out of bed with student debt and decide you're going to do a 500 unit apartment building in Ottawa. So there really were no resources, and that was the biggest challenge. Like, you couldn't just get online and type in real estate development and get all these incredible podcasts and articles and this kind of free mentorship that wasn't around. And that was probably the biggest struggle that I had, is if you don't have that, you just got to go out and do it. And when you're just doing it, you're making a lot of mistakes, right? And mistakes can be costly. And in this industry, it doesn't take much for a mistake to be fatal.
Yeah, you don't have a $20 mistake.
That's right. Yeah, they're, you know, you typically are fully leveraged with everything you own and everything you have. And a mistake isn't just, oh, okay, I'll just try something else tomorrow. It's I lose everything, and I'm really in a very very precarious position. So the risk is significant, and certainly was much greater than it is today, because people do have this kind of a resource where they can get a certain amount of knowledge practically for free, right? And now they even have at Carleton University, they have a program in real estate development, right? Which they just instituted just last year. So Ben Gianni, who's the former director of the School of Architecture, is one of the founders of that program. So now there's higher education for people in the industry that can gain real credible knowledge in the industry. And then there's an entire ecosystem of the kind of conversations that we're having today that people can tap into. So that would have been the number one thing that I wish I could have had back then. We were just saying that, you know, if we went back in time, what would you change? And I'd say everything. I would change everything, right, if I had the knowledge that I had today. And so I would encourage people to really tap into these resources and get as much out of them as they can, because, you know, you might think that, you know, you're going to be spending an hour or two listening to some podcast might not gain you much. But if it means you avoid that one mistake that might either, you know, kill your business or find that one opportunity that will make your business, it's time well invested, particularly if it just allows you to just be a little bit more efficient and save something that might cost you a couple of days or weeks or months of effort or going around in circles, right? How good of an investment in time is it to have the opportunity to have the time spent on this kind of research and time and
absolutely
in doing this.
Anthony Robbins, who I follow quite a lot, calls it net time, where he says no extra time. And so put in this education on things you're doing anyway. So if I'm going to the grocery store, I have my earphones in, I'm listening to a podcast, something that I find interesting. Sometimes it's just for fun. I'll listen to a Joe Rogan, you know, something kind of funny and humorous. Or and sometimes it's about business. It's about learning how to do a podcast or learning about real estate. Sure.
I listened to a bunch of Blinklists on the way here today, right? So it's, I encourage people to take that opportunity because there are things that we didn't have when we were starting out in our careers. And now it's out there. It means, you know, not only do you have it, but all your competition has it too. So if you're not really leveraging it to its full extent, someone else will be, and they're going to ensure that you're quickly out of business because they're going to have, you know, knowledge base that is going to be superior to yours.
Absolutely. So it's always been a trend, sort of, there's always new business building systems coming out. You know, there's always something creative or the newest, hottest trend. Do you typically try to stay on the cutting edge of stuff, or are you building more conventional? When people are looking at these systems, how do you view it?
It's a great question because, you know, personally, I'm deeply interested in technology and you know, what's coming in the future. I'm deeply excited about it, right? I'm like a geeky futurist. But it's hard to apply these things to this industry because of the risk involved. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it would be nice to do some of these things and to implement them, but they're extremely risky. And so, you know, a good example is this isn't any great amount of tech. This is just a legislative change, but, you know, in Ontario now, you can build 6-story buildings in wood, mm-hmm. right? And the industry has been you know, asking for that for a long time. This is something you were able to do in British Columbia for a long time. You can do 8 stories in British Columbia. They're planning buildings around the world that are in 20 to 40 stories. So they're doing like skyscrapers in wood, right? So we can finally do 6 stories in Ontario, and it's meant to be one, environmentally more beneficial, but it's also meant to be more cost effective than doing it in concrete, which is really your only other option. Right. Apart from, you know, like a comm slab building, you can do a hybrid building, but that's from experience, not something I would recommend to anyone. However, you know, as much interest as I have in this opportunity and as much research as I did do in this and having the, you know, the background of an architect, it's not something I jumped into because of the amount of risk associated with it, right? So then, you know, yes, on paper, these things might pencil out to being a little bit more cost effective, but you know, is the industry caught up to it? Like, you know, are there trades that can actually perform this work? Are there trades that have built buildings like this? You know, is there a supply chain for this? Would a bank understand, you know, a proforma that tries to take into account some of these cost savings? You know, would that be validated? Would a quantity surveyor validate that? So these are all risk factors, and when you add them all up, it sometimes is better to be, you know, not to be the first mover, particularly if you're small and you're growing, right? Like, it's a little bit different if you're Tridel or some major company that can, you know, that's doing 100 large scale projects a year. I can take one and run it as a test case, right? So there's larger players that will do that, and you know, I'll follow what they're doing, and I'll follow their experiences and their wins and their losses, and eventually these things will catch up. But looking forward, you're going to see tremendous disruption in every industry in the next 10 years, particularly with automation, with AI, with the change in modes of transport. I mean, these will absolutely revolutionize cities to a degree that we can barely fathom today. So the cities that we see today within 10 years won't look like they do today in any way, shape, form whatsoever. So within 10 years, you're going to see buildings being 3D printed. You're going to see an opportunity to be able to travel from Toronto to Shanghai in about an hour. You're going to be able to fly within minutes from one side of the city to the other on autonomous drones. Of course, all vehicle transport will be autonomous and electrified by that point. So that's going to reshape city fabric and buildings and consumer needs and demands to a degree that we've never experienced, and in an incredibly short period of time, right? So 10 years on a development horizon is extremely short, right? Like, if it takes 3 years, 3 to 4 years to develop a large building, that's, you know, only 2.5 cycles
before you get these changes. The city planners and a lot of them are still thinking, even though they want the future side, the building code hasn't caught up to some of these new techniques.
And right. So if you look at the policy statements and kind of the first draft of the official plan was just released just last week. So if you read through the document, it's a bold document and it does really look to the future. And I think it'll be good for Ottawa. But I think people aren't really taking into account how dramatic the changes will be and how impactful they will be. Maybe they'll filter down to Ottawa a little bit later than they would to Boston or New York, but they're going to be here and they're going to impact us significantly. And so anytime there is a disruption in any market, it brings unbelievable opportunities, right? So, if I could give some guidance to people that are getting into this industry, that I would say, do your research carefully, as I've suggested, but then also look to the future and look at how these technologies are going to be reshaping cities, because I can't overestimate how impactful that will be.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's great. So that's incredible. Is there one technology in particular you think that's really going to have the biggest shift, or something that if you told me today, because now I'm going to do it because I'm a geek like you and I like to research, I'm going to say cities of the future space. What should I be researching?
I would look at Peter Diamandis, who's the founder of the XPRIZE, and see what he's talking about. And you can sign up to some emails that he sends out periodically that will give you a good glimpse into what's happening in the future. But in terms of how cities will be affected, look at what Uber's doing with autonomous car fleets. Same with Tesla. Look at what Uber is doing with VTOLs. This isn't stuff of the future. They're gaining approvals from the U.S. government to put this out to consumer use within the next 2 years, right? Like, they're testing this stuff already, and soon people will be getting rides in autonomous.
I think it's Berlin. I saw that they had an autonomous VTOL that was a taxi cab company was actually doing. Rise.
Well, they're doing it in Dubai right now, yeah. Right? They're doing it in Dubai right now, and they're going to be doing it in North America soon. The technology is there. The legislative framework is being put into place. The business case is there, and it's just a question of rolling it out. And that's happening, in the next couple of years. It's not going to be in Ottawa in 2 years from now, but, if it's in New York in 2 years, it'll be in Ottawa in four, and that's not that far away. I mean, that's really not that far away. If you're building planning a building right now, by the time it's finished, is going to be 3 to 4 years from now, right? So are you planning to have V2Ls land on your roof? Maybe you should be, right? What's going to happen to garages when most people won't have cars anymore within the next 4 to 5 years, right? Most car manufacturers are going to be phasing out combustion engines within the next 4 to 5 years. Elon Musk, who's extremely bullish about his projections for Tesla, is saying that by the end of next year, he's going to have his entire car fleet capable of level 4, level 5 autonomy, which at that point, there is no financial incentive to buy anything other than an autonomous Tesla, because it'll pay for itself. It'll generate revenue. I mean, cars don't generate revenue. They lose money. They're going to start to generate revenue. So then what happens if people stop buying cars? Because it's cheaper to just hail a ride than it is to buy a vehicle, right? Then they stop owning cars. They don't need to park vehicles anymore, right? They don't need parking spots. And that's somewhat impactful.
Well, if you told me 5 years ago that I'd be telling my 17-year-old daughter to, hey, jump in a car with a stranger instead of me going to pick her up, I would have said you were crazy.
It's crazy, yeah. Right? That's absolutely crazy. And now it's not. It's totally normal. And then, a couple of years from now, a car with no one in it is going to drive up and take your daughter away. And that might sound crazy now, but you'll realize later that it's probably safer. But what happens to larger buildings when you no longer have cars and you no longer have to go six stories underground with parking? What happens to existing buildings that have all that amount of parking and they don't need it anymore? How do you use that space? What happens when, people are more comfortable living a larger commute from where they currently work because they can work more productively during the commute, right? So you're not just going to see an ability to be able to, work on your laptop or watch a movie as you're commuting to work, but there'll be vehicles that are that are designed to facilitate those commutes. So ones that have beds, ones that have offices, I mean, literally offices on wheels. So you get in, you start your workday as you're commuting to your office.
I'd love to go to sleep and wake up in Toronto.
They can, exactly, right? Right. And then, so what happens to the city and how it continues to grow? Is it continue to densify as it is, or are there going to be nodes, you know, dispersed around a city that will in turn begin to densify to a certain extent, because people still want that level of walkability and opportunity for amenities, but you know they don't want to pay $600 to $1,000 per square foot to live downtown. They want to pay $500 per square foot to live in a suburban center, but they still want it to be a center. And so, you know, what are the real estate opportunities in those kind of, you know, secondary markets, and how does that play out? And then what happens when you can fly on Elon Musk's rocket from Toronto to Shanghai in an hour and a half, right? What happens to real estate that's in proximity of one of these launch stations or launch terminals, you know? And then how does that change how people work and how they commute? What happens when there's telepresence and you don't need to go to work because you can be there in the form of telepresence? The cities are going to drastically change. And then there's AI that on top of everything, and everything's being automated and robots. And like you can really kind of go down a rabbit hole with this stuff. But the message is that cities are going to change, and they're going to change in a fundamental way that's beyond anything that we can conceptualize, because the human brain isn't very good at projecting change. We're really good at stasis. And the problem with, not the problem, but I guess the challenge with the coming growth is that growth itself is increasing at an exponential rate, right? And change is changing at an exponential rate. So it's not the same level of change that we're used to. You know, what the exchange that our parents have experienced over the last 50 or 60 years, or the change society's experienced over the last hundred years is going to happen in the next 10 years, right? Absolutely. Or more. And it's certainly going to be more impactful. And, you know, and are we ready for that? And are we ready for those opportunities?
Well, 25 years ago, so when you and I started our careers, most of the companies that we believe are like the foundations of our economies didn't exist.
Correct. Yeah.
So right. Yeah.
Did you have Facebook or Uber or Google or any of those things? When we started, I went to New York and saw billboards for websites, and I thought, that's absolutely crazy. Who would pay for billboards for a website? Like, they haven't figured out how to make money off websites yet. Like, you know, what a waste of time that is.
Well, I used to, you know, in my business in the mortgage side, we used to have to fax mortgage applications. And now I had a customer about 2 weeks ago that said, can you fax me something? I'm like, how the hell do I do that?
Yeah. What's a fax?
Yeah, I had to go find a way to fax somebody because I just, you know, didn't even remember anymore. But listen, Jake, thank you very much. Like I said, we could talk for hours, and I definitely want to have you back on to maybe discuss this technology directly, and maybe we can do a deeper dive into that, because that's just fascinating. But thanks. I really appreciate it.